Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Sixth Division, the Honorable Justice Mary L. Mickford presiding, case number 21-1353, Robert Glover versus City of Chicago.
Thank you, Darren. Welcome, counsel. Before we begin, I would like counsel for both the appellant and the appellee who have been argued today to give us your names, and counsel for the appellant, if you can tell us if you want to reserve any of your 20 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Elizabeth Bartolucci. I'm representing the plaintiff appellant, Robert Glover, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Counsel?
And I'm Julian Henricus, and I'll be representing the City of Chicago and police officers Tupiachi and McLean Hall.
Okay. All right. Ms. Bartolucci, whenever you're ready, you may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. The question the court is being asked to answer here is whether defendants have met their burden in establishing as a matter of law that they were not executing or enforcing the law as contemplated under Section 2-202 of the Tort Immunity Act during the events that led to plaintiff's shooting. Whether Section 4102 or 4107 could apply at all is almost immaterial. At this procedural stage, it is the defendant's burden to show that Section 2-202 does not apply. Plaintiff maintains they have not. Defendants have not sustained their burden of proving that they were not executing or enforcing the law during the events that led to plaintiff's shooting. Specifically, defendants submitted no evidence in support of their 2619 motion to dismiss regarding what they believe they were doing at the scene of the shooting. But the allegations of the complaint, which is the only truly relevant document here since we are at the pleading stage, clearly established that the defendants were responding to the call of a crime, multiple crimes, in fact, in progress. The shooter had threatened to kill the plaintiff, had threatened to conduct a mass shooting in the bar. He had stated that he had a gun, and the police were responding to that. This was not community caretaking. This was not the general provision of police protection services. This was an active enforcement.
Have you withdrawn? It looks like you have, but I just want to be clear. You've withdrawn the allegation based on the defendant's failure to make an arrest, correct?
Yes, we did formally withdraw that allegation, Your Honor. As the court might observe, the Tort Immunity Act is somewhat of a minefield. And unfortunately, certain words can trigger certain immunities, but what should rule at the end of the day are the core facts of a case. And here, the core facts of the case are that Mr. Glover, having had a confrontation and been threatened by Mr. Glover, chose to remain inside the bar. The bar owner agreed with that and sent Mr. Grayson, the shooter, out of the bar. In that scenario, Mr. Glover was perfectly safe, and he was waiting to see what would occur, presumably hoping Grayson would leave the scene. In any event, however, hooray, the police are here. The police arrived, and in their attempts to break up the situation entirely, to the extent they might have believed Mr. Glover was also somewhat a protagonist, they talked to Grayson for approximately 10 minutes, and he was insisting that Glover come out and apologize to him. So that suggests he was still in a highly animated state. Regardless of that, and regardless of having been told that Grayson had a gun, and Grayson admitting to the police that he had threatened to kill plaintiff, the police then instructed plaintiff to come out of the bar, to come out his place of safety and confront Grayson once again. And predictably, the two then began another altercation, at which point the police instructed my client, Mr. Glover, to go to his car and Mr. Grayson to leave the scene. And within 39 seconds, my client had been shot multiple times. So in this case, it's almost impossible to see how this was not the execution or enforcement of the law.
How does this ultimately get sorted out? Because an argument could certainly be made, and I'm sure your opposing counsel will make it, that this was also police protective services. They were trying to avoid a confrontation. They came and tried to break it up. They tried to protect people. How does it ultimately get decided which it was?
Well, Your Honor, if we look at the case law, and obviously that would be very appropriate for the court to do, to look at precedent construing Section 2-202 and look at the case law where courts have evaluated where officers were executing or enforcing the law. And there are fact patterns that are extremely similar to this one.
My question is it a jury question? Is it a question? How does that ultimately get made? Does it get made by a jury? Assuming it gets past summary judgment, it gets made by a jury based on instructions. Is that what happens in your view?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that could happen unless, let's say, the defendants are deposed and they admit that they were executing or enforcing the law. Plaintiff would probably be entitled to summary judgment then. But if we don't get to a summary judgment disposition, yes, I believe a jury could be asked to conclude.
You think it's a binary question? Police are either executing and enforcing the law or they're providing protective services. They're never doing both.
Well, Your Honor, I think they could be doing both, but that's where we get to the procedural status here and the defense burden of persuasion. We're looking at, first of all, this is a complaint alleging willful and wanton conduct. In response to the complaint, the defendants have asserted affirmative defenses. So out of the gate, it is their burden of persuasion on their affirmative defenses. In response to those affirmative defenses, you know, they invoke the Tort Immunity Act and say we are immune under the Tort Immunity Act, specifically these two provisions. Plaintiffs respond to their affirmative defenses, wait, you are not immune under the Tort Immunity Act because there's another provision under which you could be held liable for willful and wanton conduct. So it's the defendant's burden of persuasion at this stage to—
Right, but that's proof. The issue that Justice Mikva just raised, and I want to come back to it for a second. So we have a situation where there are two possibilities of which of the two tort immunity provisions apply. And the case law seems to say that the one that's more specifically applicable would apply. So the question is, who's going to make that decision? Ultimately, should that decision be made by the trial court or by the trier of fact?
I believe that determination is one that's appropriate for the court. It could ultimately be a jury question, but here the defendants are asking the court to resolve it as a matter of law. So they are, if it is a potential jury question, defendants are trying to take it away from a jury. I believe that the court could appropriately make that decision as this court has done in multiple prior cases.
Because there's been no discovery, you don't believe that decision can be made yet. That's your position. Is that correct?
Well, I believe it could be made for purposes of a 2619 motion to dismiss. I do believe, and that's where I was leading with my discussion, that it's the defendant's burden of persuasion on their affirmative defense, but it's also their burden of persuasion under 2619. Under 2619, the complaint and all allegations or evidence that was submitted, which there was none in the proceedings below, it's the complaint alone, have to be construed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. So if there's a determination that has to be made now, which there is, the court is to construe the complaint in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. So in doing so, it must say that 202 is the section that applies. Thirdly, the Tort Immunity Act itself, case law instructs us, must be strictly and narrowly construed. That statutory scheme was enacted in derogation of the common law, and courts unanimously say it's to be narrowly and strictly construed against the finding of immunity. So yes, at this juncture on a 2619 motion to dismiss, it is absolutely within the province of the court to decide whether defendants have established as a matter of law that their affirmative defense prevails and wins the day, which they just cannot do. They haven't established that they weren't enforcing or executing the law, i.e. they haven't established that they're immune from liability, which is their affirmative defense. They have suggested that two other statutes potentially apply, but there's still 202. They can't just ignore 202. And getting to the heart of what the parties discussed, if the court has to decide which section is most specifically applicable, I think the facts here bear out that, and as Justice Mikva intimated, couldn't both be happening? Yes, both could be happening. There could be police protective services being given and police could be executing or enforcing the law. But here, when you look at the case law construing 4102, police protection services are usually much more generic and general, like closing a street for a parade, directing public viewers to where they should stand for a fireworks display. Here, we have police officers actively responding to a call of threatened gun violence. That is executing or enforcing the law. The fact that nobody said they're enforcing section 25-7 of the municipal code is not what's necessary. That's not required at the pleading stage. But under the facts, this is not general police protective services. This is a response. And as the case law bears out, I mean, we have at least 7 cases where police responding to radio reports of crimes in progress, responding to a call of shots fired, even escorting a witness to a show-up identification was considered executing or enforcing the law. It just doesn't seem possible to reconcile the facts here with those cases and not find that 202 is applicable and more specifically applicable.
But either way, isn't the first question issue of duty? Wouldn't that be the first question we need to resolve?
No, Your Honor. I mean, obviously in assessing a pleading, you do look to whether the elements of negligence or willful and wanton conduct have been pled. But here our contention is the circuit court denied all of the defendant's 2615 motions to dismiss in which the duty issue was addressed. Defendants have not appealed from any of those 2615 denials. And as we've argued, they were required to do so. And they have forfeited.
I'm sorry, counsel. They got everything they wanted. They got the case dismissed. Why would they file a prosecution?
Because, Your Honor, as I've indicated in our briefs, and as the court certainly knows, 2615 and 2619 are two separate statutes. They have completely separate grounds and standards of decision. And the fact that parties are allowed to file combined section 615 and 619 motions to dismiss doesn't make them the same thing. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen at various junctures in a case, a 2615 was denied, but then a 2619 was granted. They're still very independent motions. And if the party...
You think that we ought to be encouraging parties who've gotten a case dismissed, defendants that got a case dismissed, to then appeal to us because they don't like the grounds?
No, Your Honor, not appeal, but cross appeal if they want to raise their 2615, their rejected 2615 arguments. Yes. Because, I mean, there's case law that says that. If the...
And what case are you relying on?
I'll pull that up for you, Your Honor.
You're probably relying on Clays. That's the one you cite.
I'm sorry, which Clays, yeah, versus Village of Palatine. That's the most on point. And even the cases discussed by the defendants, such as Material Services Corp, still indicate that if an underlying judgment is adverse in any respect, not just an adverse finding, that's where there's a distinction here. Sometimes in these cases, there has been an adverse finding to a party, but here we have an adverse judgment. The judgment here was in two parts. It denied the 2615 motion to dismiss and it granted the 2619 motion. That is an adverse
judgment dismissing your case. The judgment dismissed your case. That's what the judgment did. Why would they appeal?
On one ground, they don't have to appeal, but they have to cross appeal if they want to address their 615 argument. I think that's what the case law says. The case law addresses claims by plaintiffs.
Ms. Bartolucci, putting aside the forfeiture argument, why don't you address the merits of the duty issue?
All right, Your Honor. So the duty here begins with the common law duty that every individual owes to another, not to create a risk of harm to them, and to protect against a foreseeable risk of harm. As we mentioned, the facts here also support the finding of a special relationship between the plaintiff and defendants in that the defendants voluntarily undertook to protect or intervene in the situation, we'll call it. They is our position that this falls within the duty obligation imposed under the restatement, section 314A4, which provides the person who takes custody of another so as to deprive that person of their normal avenues of protection has a duty to protect that person against unreasonable risk of harm. Here, there was already a risk of harm to the plaintiff due to Grayson's presence. However, the police exacerbated and increased that risk of harm by making him come out of his place of safety. His place of safety was his other avenue of protection, and the police deprived him of that. the coercive or compelling effect of a police instruction directing you to come out of somewhere and then to go to your car is very strong, and it amounts to custody for purposes of this custodian custody duty under the restatement. So there was a duty not to create a risk of foreseeable harm or increase the risk of foreseeable harm, and then not to exacerbate the situation. And the defendants here did all of that. Mr. Glover was in the bar safely, thanks to himself and the bar owner's protections. And it was the police who made him come out, again confront and incite the shooter, and then walk to his car unprotected and get shot.
So you're basically, the trial court got it right on the 2615.
Yes, Your Honor. I do believe the judge got it right on the 2615 aspect. And due to the forfeiture issue, I don't think that's an issue, but I don't think the court needs to concern itself with duty, because I think it's very clearly there under either the common law duty or the restatement duty, and the special relationship under 314A4 of custodian protectee. So there being the duty, the question next would be breach, and that obviously is typically a jury question, and we're nowhere near there because we're still at the pleading stage. But I believe the plaintiff has pled sufficient facts to establish, and the circuit court agreed, the existence of a legal duty. So the next question will be breach and proximate cause of damages, and those should be allowed to proceed to a jury. Defendants are trying to stop the entire case short at this phase by saying, no, we're completely immune from our acts and omissions, even though we are executing and enforcing the law, because this really falls under 4102, which in reality, if you look at it, every single omission there is phrased as an omission, a failure to do something. Every one of them is a failure to do something by the police. Here, we're not necessarily alleging failures, although we believe they occurred, but we're alleging active increase of the risk of harm to the plaintiff. And if you look at even the Wisnowski case, which defendants cite, that case examined whether 4102 contains an express contains an exception for active steps taken by police. So in reviewing the language of the statute itself, the court and the parties couldn't even tell if it covered active participation by the police or only addressed negligent failures by police. And because that is the wording of 412, every single statement in there addresses a failure to provide adequate police protection, failure to prevent crimes, and the failure to identify or apprehend criminals. Here, those are all failures, but we contend what the defendants were doing was executing or enforcing the law, which is active and which seems directly addressed by 2-202. They were executing or enforcing the law when they arrived at that scene. They were doing their job, responding to a radio call of a gun threat. They were there within 3 minutes. There were multiple laws that Grayson had already
You're out of time, so just if you have a quick first, does anybody on the panel have any more questions? Okay, so if you just want to make a conclusion, then you can come back on the bubble and respond. Okay.
I think I'm fine. I'll just rest there.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Yes, may it please the court. In our brief, Glover argues at length in his reply brief that this court lacks jurisdiction to consider our contention concerning the duty ground because we didn't file a cross appeal. But Glover is wrong. We didn't need to file a cross appeal for this court to have jurisdiction to consider the duty ground as an alternative ground for affirmance of the judgment. And this is made clear by the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in the material service case, which we cited in our brief. Plaintiff's confusion is not to adhere to what a judgment is. The judgment in this case was solely the dismissal of the case. It had nothing to do with the grounds, the findings, anything else about whether 2615 was the reason or whether 2619 was the reason. The judgment, it consisted exclusively of the dismissal of the case. This court has jurisdiction to consider our argument that for affirmance of the judgment on the alternative ground of duty.
Okay, but let me ask you this, assuming you're right, why'd you start there?
Why did I start there?
Why did you start with 2615 when you lost that one instead of 619 that you won on?
Well, in light of the case law that we cite in our brief that says that the natural progression of the logic of these cases is duty. So we started there with duty. I think our duty argument is no stronger or weaker than our argument concerning the Tort Immunity Act, as I'll explain as I go through the discussion of both of them. But since we did argue duty first in our brief, I'll address that first. And then I'll proceed to the immunity ground. Now, in his reply brief, Glover makes two arguments concerning duty, but neither of his arguments contends that he alleged the particular duty that the circuit court sua sponte concluded that the officers owed him. Now, remember, the circuit court made up this duty that has nothing to do with either a special duty or a duty of ordinary care. The circuit court concocted this duty from section 2202 of the Tort Immunity Act. Section 2202 of the Tort Immunity Act, which is an immunity provision. And yet section 1-101.1 of the Tort Immunity Act says that the act doesn't create duties, it only creates immunities and defenses. So that was wrong off the bat to concoct a new duty based on an immunity provision of the Tort Immunity Act in the face of the language of section 1-101.1 of the Tort Immunity Act. In any event, now Glover's arguments are both of Glover's arguments that he presents in his reply brief are new. He made neither of them in the circuit court, and he thereby waived or forfeited both of them. In any event, both of his new arguments are wrong on the merits.
But on the 615, if we were to rule against you, we'd be affirming. So we can affirm on any ground we want, right? We can decide to 615 on any basis we want.
That's correct. That's correct. One of the new arguments that Glover makes in his reply brief is that the amended complaint alleges that he and the officers were in one of the special relationships that under the common law would be necessary to establish that they owed a special duty to protect him from Grayson. The special relationship he contends he has had with the officers is that of protectee and voluntary custodian. But as Glover expressly acknowledges, that relationship is defined by section 314A4 of the Restatement Second of Torts as someone, quote, taking the custody of another so as to deprive that person of his normal avenues for protection. The allegations of Glover's admitted complaint do not satisfy those requirements. Specifically, the allegations do not indicate that the officers took custody of Glover. He was not arrested. He was not in custody. Nor do they indicate that the officers deprived Glover of his normal avenues of protection. In particular, there is absolutely no reason to believe the officers would have prohibited Glover from waiting to go to his car until after Grayson departed the scene.
But I think also they're arguing that the officers created this situation and created a duty when they called him out and brought him into harm's way, that he was safely in the bar. They were dealing with Mr. Grayson, and Mr. Grayson convinced them that they shouldn't be talking to him, but that instead they should be talking to Glover. And then they eventually called Glover out. So again, the argument that counsel's making, and whether that argument was made in the complaint, is something different because they weren't given an opportunity to file an amended complaint. The case was dismissed with prejudice. So if they were to go back, maybe they would file an amended complaint. Maybe they'd make it clear that what was going on here is that the officers created that duty and placed him into harm's way. Do you want to respond to that? That's just their argument. I haven't taken a position.
Yes. Well, There's a lot there. The first thing is that it's still the duty is still a duty, a special duty to protect someone from harm. Whether the officers created it or not, it's still a duty to protect someone from harm. It doesn't have anything to do with whether it's created or not. The officers had a special duty to protect him from harm. And that duty requires that he be in a special relationship with one of the four types of special.
But not if they've created the situation. It doesn't require a special relationship. We all have a duty to avoid unreasonable harm. So if they created this dangerous condition or dangerous situation, if you will, and now they didn't protect him after creating the situation, taking him from his place of safety. Again, this is their argument, and they're arguing that therein where this that's where the duty lies. And now we get to the next issue after we determine whether or not there's a duty.
Their argument, they certainly argue that. But out on the street, when everyone is there, the two officers, both men are there. Glover was still safe until the officers said to both of them, leave. The officers didn't create that situation. There's nothing in the allegations of the complaint that would have indicated that Glover couldn't have said to the officers, okay, I'll leave. I'm happy to leave, but let's just let Grayson walk far enough away from me that I'm not going to be in danger for him. There's no indication in the complaint that couldn't have happened. There's nothing, no suggestion that the officers wouldn't have honored that request. It's a perfectly simple and easy request to honor. No reason to believe that the officers, sent him to be slaughtered.
Don't we at this point have to construe this complaint very favorably to the plaintiff? Is there possible, that could be, that there was certainly nothing inconsistent with that possibility? It was alleged that the officers directed him to go to the car. He responds and how much he pushed back, we don't know any of that.
It's almost impossible, I think, to imagine that the officers cared to require him to leave first and would have said, you go first, and without constraining Grayson. There's absolutely, one can imagine anything, but it's simply hard to, they pled this, and certainly if they would have pled that the officers would not have allowed him to leave to go to his car, it would be a different story. But based on the allegations of this complaint, a reasonable construction of this complaint is that it would not be reasonable to assume that the officers would have required him to go to his car before Grayson left the scene. For that reason, the officers were subject to the special duty. Grace Glover was safe at that moment.
Mr. Enriquez, let me stop you, because it seems to me that, you're compartmentalizing this case. As I understand the allegation, and there's really two salient allegations. The police officers were notified that Grayson, Mr. Grayson had threatened to shoot Mr. Glover inside the bar. Fortunately, the bar owner or manager was able to convince Mr. Grayson to exit. The police officers arrived on the scene, and then the police officers directed Mr. Glover to come out. A reasonable inference may be drawn that the police officers placed Mr. Glover in the cauldron when moments before he was in the safety of the bar. And so why doesn't that give rise to not only a duty, but a question of fact about whether they acted willfully and wantonly in the execution and enforcement of the law?
Well, first of all, the allegations of the complaint say the officers requested Glover to leave the bar. They didn't direct him to leave the bar. They requested.
So let me stop you there. you know, a reasonable person faced with a request by a police officer may not understand that it's optional. And, you know, a reasonable fact finder can make that determination. Would you agree?
But either way, some people might or some people might not, but Glover is the master of his complaint. He alleged that the officers requested. He understood that it was a request. There was no there was no suggestion in the complaint that Glover would have wanted to refuse and reluctantly came out.
Does the complaint allege that Mr. Glover understood this request to be, you know, optional, that he could refuse to comply? Does the complaint actually allege that?
No, it doesn't allege that he considered it optional or not, but it doesn't say that he considered it his obligation to come out. He just said the officers requested him to leave, and at their request, he left. Once they're on the street, in any event, once they're on the street, even if the officers had said, please come out here, or come out here, we order you to come out here, and they're out on the street, at that point, the two men make gestures to each other and have cross words again with each other. And the officers end up hoping to solve the problem by sending both men on their way. There's no indication at all in this situation. It's hard to imagine police officers who wouldn't have honored a request by Glover. He said, look, you're separating us. Let's let Glover go far enough away that I can go to my car. He didn't do that.
And well, we don't know that because there's been no discovery.
Well, certainly with the detail that's alleged in the complaint, one wouldn't leave that out if that had been any suggestion. He's the master of his complaint. If he wanted to say, I felt obligated to leave, even though Grayson was still waiting here, still here and could have followed me away. If he wanted to say that, he certainly would have said that in his complaint. I think probably what happened is he thought that if he went to his car and left, the police officers would have prevented Glover from crossing the street and following him. He didn't know what happened after he walked away. And so the officers then do make a mistake and don't hold Glover there. Glover then goes across the street, but there's no suggestion that Mr. Glover felt compelled to go at that moment without at least the assumption that the officers are going to prohibit Grayson from leaving.
Counsel, you only have about 5 minutes left, so unless there's other questions, I'd like you to address the immunity.
Okay.
All right, with the panel.
I'll do that. And it looks like I would have gone into detail with the allegations of the complaint step by step by step. But the salient aspect of this is that, again, Glover was the master of his complaint. And in it, he said that based on its allegations concerning the shooting incident, the officers, quote, failed to protect him from being shot by Jeremy Grayson. Those are the words Glover used in his own amended complaint to characterize this claim. And that characterization by Glover is the most salient aspect of this case, but because it captures the gravamen of the incident precisely. And significantly, it also matches almost identically the language of Section 4102 of the Tort Immunity Act, which confers absolute immunity from liability for the, quote, failure to provide police protection or adequate police protection. Glover, so that matches almost exactly the language of his own amended complaint, characterizing the shooting incident. Glover relies instead on a different provision of the Act, Section 2202, which immunizes only ordinary negligence, not willful and wanton conduct. But the language of Section 2202 is not nearly as close to Glover's own amended complaint's characterization of his claim as the language of 4102 is.
Well, but counsel, we're allowed, are we not, not just to look at his characterization, but his factual allegations and the scenario as a whole, and whether this scenario as a whole could be viewed as executional enforcement of the law.
That's certainly so, but there's no indication at all that his characterization, which captures precisely the step-by-step description, his step-by-step allegations, his description of the incident. There's no indication at all that when he said that what happened in this case is the officers failed to protect me, that's what anybody would look at and say, or almost anybody would look at and say, that's what happened in this case. And guess what? That is the language of 4102. It's not the specific language of 2202. Now, it's true that the officers may have been thinking that they were also executing or enforcing the law at the same time. But, you know, the case law is that if there's more than one provision of the act that might apply, the most specific immunity provision applies. And there's hardly any.
Why is 4102 any more specific than the execution enforcement qualified immunity provision? Why? They're both very broad, as opposed to 107, which is very specific, but both of those provisions are very broad.
Well, the execution of the enforcement of the law can involve many different things, one of which is the providing police protection. The police protection is much more specific in a situation than 2202 in most situations. And this is one of those situations. Section 2202 can be more specific in certain situations, but not in a situation like this, where the actual protection of a human being, of the known circumstance that a human being might be in danger, or that is what's at issue. That one might call that executing or enforcing the law, or a situation involving executing enforcing the law, but clearly the act of protecting someone from injury, from being shot by someone else who's threatened to shoot someone, is the epitome of the protection or enforcement of the law. And it certainly,
Mr. Enriquez, doesn't matter what the police officers think they were there for. In other words, if they were to be deposed and they were to be asked, well, what were you doing there? You know, what was your role there? Does it matter what they say?
I don't think so. I don't think it matters at all. I think that what matters is what plaintiff thought that the officer, what the officer should have been doing. The officers might not have thought that they needed to execute or enforce, to protect it. But that's what 4102 is about. It's the failure to protect. Officers probably wouldn't say they failed to protect if they thought that they were there to protect. And yet that would be true almost all the time. Almost every officer would say, well, I didn't fail to protect. I didn't think I was there to protect. And yet from the plaintiff's standpoint, his interest is, I wanted to be protected, and the officers failed to do that. That's why he alleged the complaint this way. He alleged it because—
Mr. Rukes, I'm not sure that you meant to answer Justice Taylor's question that it was strictly what Mr. Glover thought that matters here. I think it really boils down to what was really going on, not what Mr. Glover thought. But I have a different question for you. My question is, you argue, and I want you to respond to this only because I'm going to ask Ms. Bartolucci the same question. You argue that even if they were at the time enforcing the law, that by the time they sent everyone in their different, or the two individuals in their different direction, they were no longer for enforcing the law. So at the time of the incident, they were not enforcing the law. Do you want to explain that to us a little bit as to how you get there?
Well, the Albert case actually goes through this and specifically says that an officer at one point can be enforcing the law and can then stop enforcing the law. Once the officers on the street sent them on their way and they both departed, the officers had no way to do anything else at that point. They couldn't have been enforcing the law. They did kick in again and enforce the law as soon as Glover as soon as Grayson shot Glover, they went
after. Just to be clear, you're saying that in this encounter, if we were to look at it that way, there was only about 39 seconds, as Ms. Bartolucci puts it, about 39 seconds in which they were not enforcing the law. And then all the other time they were enforcing the law. That's how we would interpret your last statement.
Well, whether or not they were enforcing the law or not, for before those 39 seconds, certainly during those 39 seconds, they were no longer, because the two men were no longer with them. They had no way of doing anything. They couldn't do anything at all. Had another crime been committed at that point, they could have pursued whoever committed the crime. And indeed, Grayson committed the crime by shooting Glover and they pursued it. There was no question, but at least that moment. Now that's a very micro way of looking at these circumstances that the Albert case thought would be an important aspect of the case. It doesn't seem very important to me in this case, because whether or not the officers might have somehow, one might try to concoct a theory about why the officers were still enforcing the law, even during those 39 seconds, perhaps one could think of something I can't think of. But even if that were so, they clearly were not protecting him. And that's the failure to protect. They were not protecting them. They were away from him and they failed to do what was necessary to protect him. That's the paradigm of this case.
But that's also the crux of this issue here is whether or not 202 applies or whether or not 4102 applies to this, which one is applicable to this situation. That's what needs to be resolved. And that's, so you're saying that it's clear, well, and of course, Ms. Bartolucci is arguing that it's not so clear. In fact, she believes that it's clear that 202 applies.
Well, as you pointed out, one of the questions in this case is, suppose both provisions apply.
Right.
Which is the more specific? Mm-hmm. It can hardly be doubted that if 2202 applies, 4102 certainly does. So that if 202 applies, 4102 is the more specific one, as we talked about a minute ago. It is the paradigm. He alleges it in his complaint. Those are his own words, that the failure to protect was what he was interested in when he brought this lawsuit. He was suing because the officers had what he called a special duty to protect him from Grayson. That's how he alleges, his own words, the master of the amended complaint alleged it just that way. As far as this question about whether there was any evidence in this case, we cite in our brief the case law indicating that in a 2619 situation like this, the allegations of the amended complaint can be the affirmative matter that defeats the claim. And in this case, the complaint itself is what defeats the claim. Try as they may, they can't get around it. Now, the Tort Immunity Act was created.
Okay. I'm going to stop you because we're not going to go there. You're out of time. And so unless there are other questions, your time is really up. Is there a last point you want to make without giving us the history of the Tort Immunity Act?
No, I think for the reasons that we've expressed, the judgment in favor of the city and the officers should be affirmed.
Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Defense counsel made a statement in answering your questions that I think really sums it up perfectly. He said, if section 2-202 applies, then certainly 4102 applies. That means 202 is a subset of 4102. And that is our position. Providing police protection services is a very broad, generic description of something a public entity and its employees can do. You can provide police protection services in a number of ways, including such things as directing traffic for a parade. That's not executing or enforcing the law. Here, executing or enforcing the law is a subset, a subactivity within a local public entity's provision of public protection services. That pretty much answers the question that you're trying to answer. But to go on, I just want to note that council continues to focus on the protection issue. But Mr. Glover's complaint does specifically allege the police affirmatively caused plaintiff to exit the bar, placing him at a risk of being shot and killed. This court has a long line of precedent. This obviously is not a Fourth Amendment seizure custody issue. It's a civil setting. And so the restatement definition and interpretation of what custody is would apply. But you have a long line of case law that defines when police requests, such as, come here, does that constitute a seizure? That exact language has been held to constitute a seizure. In some cases it hasn't. I guess it depended on different facts, but there's a long line of Fourth Amendment case law that says any request by the police in circumstances like this would have been interpreted as an instruction, a direction that plaintiff could not have chosen not to follow. And he was under their custody in coming out of the bar and getting to his car. And as the case law we've cited suggests, contrary to defense counsel's analysis, courts aren't supposed to parse through by seconds here, in this case, by 39 seconds, when the police might be enforcing or not enforcing the law. One of the cases we cited involved police driving the car forward to disperse a crowd and then putting it in reverse to escape the attacking crowd.
Mr. Enriquez cites the Albert case, and the Albert case supports his position that even if the officers are enforcing the law, at some point that activity ends and they're no longer enforcing the law. And once they've gotten the two individuals to walk in different directions, that at that point they were done with what they needed to do and they could have left. So that they were no longer enforcing the law when this incident occurred. That's his argument. Do you want to respond?
I would say that they directed plaintiff to walk to his car. And if the evidence could bear out, that they expected him to fully cross the street, get into his car and leave. So I don't believe they stopped enforcing the law. I don't believe that if he had been the one who turned and ran toward Grayson, there would have been a break in that chain of events. They expected him to follow their direction to go to his car. And until he got in his car and left, they were there enforcing the law. Certainly in 39 seconds, they were there enforcing the law, making sure both men followed their direction. Either man could have turned back and attacked each other within seconds. And that's exactly what happened.
Well, so, and that's the key issue here, because if they were not enforcing the law at the time, then 202 doesn't come into play. Because it's the only way 202 comes into play.
Well, I think that's an extremely weak analysis. There's case law where the police were, as I mentioned.
That's their argument. That's Mr.
Right. No, I agree. I agree that's their argument. But I think that's not the analysis the courts apply. Courts have found enforcement or execution of the law when a police car moved forward to disperse a crowd, then became attacked by the crowd and went in reverse to retreat. To escape attack, and that was still considered executing or enforcing the law. There, the police officer was protecting himself. He wasn't protecting the crowd or anyone else.
Ms. Bartolucci, is your position that when the officers directed Mr. Glover to exit the bar, and when they subsequently directed Mr. Glover and Mr. Grayson to go to their respective vehicles, that they were enforcing the law?
Yes.
Okay.
Because one of the laws we cited is public nuisance. And I provided a very long definition of one of the municipal codes that could be at issue that they could have been enforcing, because potentially the police were viewing Glover as part of the problem. I believe both men were part of the problem. And there are several laws that they could have been enforcing and breaking them apart. So, yeah.
More specifically, let's put aside, you know, the municipal code sections or any statute. Does it constitute enforcing? Does the mere direction by a police officer to a civilian to do something or stop doing something, does that constitute enforcing the law?
I believe so, Your Honor, because it could have been deemed, the police officers could testify, we were investigating a report. We were investigating what happened. A crime had been reported. What Glover or Grayson had done already constituted a crime. So it could have been an investigation of a crime. So that's enforcement of the law. I believe investigating a crime would be deemed enforcement of the law if, as in the cases we cited, if driving a witness to an identification process is executing or enforcing the law, then certainly arriving at a scene and questioning the victim or the target of the threatened crime is certainly enforcing the law. And I do want to note, it is important, defense counsel focuses on the protection issue. And here, it was not Mr. Glover who called the police, and it was not Mr. Glover who requested police assistance. He remained in the bar. So though some of his allegations address protection, they address protection in the context of the defendants having created or increased the foreseeable risk of harm to him. He didn't call them, he didn't ask for their help. He was in the bar safe. So though he mentions the word protection in his complaint, he also says they affirmatively caused him to leave the bar and put him at risk of being shot and killed. That is the crux of the case. He didn't ask for their protection. The bar owner asked for assistance to either break up a public disturbance, prevent a mass shooting, or prevent Mr. Glover from being shot. And that's what's at issue. It's not protection in the extremely generic sense that 4102 contemplates. All of the cases that construe 4102 are much broader basic protection services. They're not actually responding to the scene of a crime. The majority of cases that address.
I'm going to stop you because you're out of time. All right. Any questions from the panel? All right. Thank you both very much. We'll take this case under advisement and we'll hear from us in due course.